This conference will now be recorded.
Right, hello everybody, and welcome to this special PBIC teleclass audio training with a very good friend of mine, a very smart guy, and somebody I've been wanting to have a chat with for a little while now. We've got a number of topics planned actually to speak to PBIC Gold and Diamond members about in the coming months, because Julian is doing a similar thing to me, repurposing content and putting it into the Kindle store and stuff as well. But anyway, that's kind of for another day. First of all, let me introduce to the call Julian Northbrook. Hello, Julian.
Hello. Hello, Dom, and hello, PBIC.
Excellent. Thank you. So, Julian, why don't you start by telling us a bit about yourself and what you do, because you have a very different job to a lot of our members, but a very different job to a lot of the people who we've spoken to before.
Cool. It's always a difficult question to answer, isn't it? What do you do? What I do depends on really what I'm into that particular day. I wear many different hats, and depending on how I feel that morning, what I do changes somewhat. I guess my bread and butter is teaching English as a second language. I run an online membership lesson kind of system. Not so different, I'd imagine, to what you're doing here with PBIC. It's very, very similar sort of thing, sort of setup. That would be my bread and butter. I'm also quite heavily active in academic research. Broadly speaking, I guess you'd say my field is psycholinguistics, with second language acquisition as kind of a subcategory to that. Basically what I'm doing is I'm actually doing a lot of research, and then that's feeding down into what I do in my business and the way that I design the lessons and the methods that I use to teach people and stuff like that. So what is
psycholinguistics then?
Okay. Are you familiar with linguistics?
Language?
Yeah, linguistics would be the study of language.
Cool.
Psycholinguistics would be a combination of psychology and linguistics. So we study how language is processed in the human brain. Well, not just the human brain, actually in the brain, because and I don't know if that's something you want to ask me about later, but animal language does come into it.
That's
a very broad stroke definition. But basically, it's language plus brain stuff.
Cool. So you essentially, which in a way is kind of, I suppose you kind of do this as well now, because you're I know you're embarking on a similar thing with teaching people about business and marketing, aren't you? But I think it's important. I stress this a number of times when I'm speaking to my guys. I think it's important that you. Well, it's almost essential for me. It's almost, if I want to teach people how to get better at marketing, it's essential that I'm a student, an ongoing student of marketing. Do you know what I mean? And I'm, you know, the history of marketing, the history of sales, you know, so you, and by being a study, by making a study of it and being passionate about it, that enables you to find new things, doesn't it, all the time to talk about, which is exactly the same as what the dog trainers and stuff should be doing as well, isn't it? You know, you're taking old lessons and new things, and you're rehashing them and then putting your own twist on them, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So interesting. Yeah. Right. So how did you, so tell us a bit about where you live and about yourself. Personal story first. This is quite interesting.
Personal story. How long do you want me to spend on this? Because I could sit here and spend all evening on this.
Give us a bit of a napkin version.
Okay.
Quickfire version.
So I guess my personal story, and I guess this goes back to the many different hats that I wear and have worn. I started life in the world of fine art, of all things. I guess I wasn't very academically minded at school, and the only thing I could really do after school, the only thing I was qualified in or able to actually do at college and then university, was art. I just happened to be pretty good at that, so I just went with it. So I spent 5 years going through art school and through university, and then did what all art students did and just kind of fell out of the system at the other end with absolutely no idea what I was supposed to do with any of it, because let's face it, getting a degree in art ain't exactly the most useful thing to get a degree in. I didn't have a clue what to do, but I I'd met a girl. And so I thought, well, since I've got nothing else to do, I'm going to follow this girl back to her home country, which just happened to be Japan.
Right.
And the idea was I was going to spend a year in Japan. And my girlfriend at the time was then going to decide whether she wanted to go back to the UK after a year or what. Or we just didn't really know what we were going to do. Just seemed like a good idea at the time. So on the plane I got, no idea what Japan was like, what kind of country I was going to. Didn't speak a word of the language. Was very optimistic about my chances of getting a job in an art gallery or in some kind of art-related position in Tokyo, which of course was stupid to say the least because I didn't speak a word of the language. I actually got a job interview at one point.
The optimism of youth.
Yeah, the optimism of you. I actually managed to get a job interview at one place because they'd advertised in English. And I got to the job interview and they were like, well, what do you mean you don't speak Japanese? You want to work in a Japanese company. Isn't it a given that you would speak Japanese? That's why it wasn't listed on the advertisement. So I realized, oh, shit, I'm not qualified for anything because I don't speak the language. So that was really the first time in my life, I guess, I realized what a barrier language can be. You know, growing up in good old monolingual England, never really thought about language or the way that I spoke or communicated with people or anything like that. But suddenly I had this big barrier in front of me.
Did you speak any other language at the time, Julian, or not?
No, I just wasn't interested. I only planned to stay here for a year. That actually turned into 12 for various reasons. But for want of anything else to do, I got a part-time job teaching English. And I actually loved it, which was a big surprise to me, to say the least. I thought I would hate it. And from there, I got into the language stuff. I learned Japanese, and I guess I just went further and further down the rabbit hole and ended up where I am now.
Interesting. So still in Tokyo.
Yep. Not for much longer.
No.
No, I'm off to Ireland. Probably in about 6 weeks, 5-6 weeks from now, actually.
Fabulous.
Yeah, I've been here for 12 years now, though.
Yeah. So
it's going to be a real culture shock.
Family all looking forward to it.
Yes and no.
With some trepidation, obviously.
Yeah, looking forward to it, but slightly nervous about the whole thing as well, I think.
It's another adventure, isn't it? Yeah. So what were the big kind of... I'm going to come on to the dog stuff in a minute because I'm quite interested in this as well, even though it's primarily sort of, you know, businessy type call. What would be a big kind... Because I've sat and we've had a few drinks and a couple of meals together over the years, and just some really interesting stuff that you've shared about the Japanese kind of culture and stuff, you know, which I'd know next to nothing about apart from speaking to you. So what were the kind of big shocks for you when you got there or since you've stayed there and lived?
Oh God, where do I start? It's so different here. There are similarities, I guess, between British culture and Japanese culture. In some ways, British culture and Japanese culture are far more similar than, say, American culture and Japanese culture. British people and Japanese people tend to be quite reserved, I think, quite humble. We tend to play ourselves down more than play ourselves up. In that respect, I guess we're quite similar. But then in other respects, there's just... it's completely different. Obviously, the language is totally different, but the way that people think is different as well. I guess, like the UK, Japan is an island country, and it's kind of developed as a very insular group culture. But unlike the UK, Japan was a closed country for a very, very, very long time, meaning they had no contact with the outside world at all. And the result of that is that Japanese culture is almost like people have this weird telepathy going on and that they understand what each other are thinking without it ever having to be expressed. I'm not sure if you're familiar with what we call language or cultural contexts. But Japanese is what we would call the highest context language in the world. American English is the lowest. And what that means is that without the context of wherever you are, what's going on around you, it's pretty difficult, if not impossible, to truly understand what's being said in the language. That's because there's so much reading between the lines going on. Whereas American English is kind of the opposite because of the way the country developed. It was all immigrants mixed together and they had to speak in a fairly simple way so that each other could understand. So American English tends to be very, very direct. What is said, what is meant, whereas Japanese culture is the opposite. That was very, very hard to get used to. And I think what happens to a lot of people when they come here, and this is where the big kind of culture shock part of it comes in. When people come here, Japanese people are extremely friendly on the surface, and people tend to misunderstand that. I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't make Japanese people come across as being two-faced, which in a way the culture is, but not necessarily in a negative sense. People tend to come here and everybody's so friendly and everybody's so kind, but what they don't realize is that's all surface level stuff. And Japanese culture makes this very, very clear distinction between the face that you put on in public in front of people and your true feelings. And that can be very hard for people to deal with once they start to grasp the reality that what people are saying to them is not necessarily what they're actually thinking and what they actually mean. That was the big cultural shock for me. And I guess I did what almost everybody does. And I went through stages of loving Japan because everybody's so friendly and everybody's so nice to me, to hating the country and hating the people because I felt that they were two-faced and fake, to accepting that it's a culture difference and learning to exist within that. And I guess do it to a certain extent myself as well.
Yeah.
That was perhaps a long answer to your question.
No, like it. And I guess that would, so to me, that would make it very difficult, if not almost impossible, to learn unless you were living there, you know? I mean, I could sit and learn it with a book and a tape and stuff, but I wouldn't know. I would literally just have, like you say, the absolute surface stuff, wouldn't I? Compared to living in the culture.
I wouldn't say you had to live here. It certainly helps because you get more opportunity to be exposed to the culture. Notice that I said to the culture there and not just to the language.
Yeah.
I mean, you certainly could learn Japanese in the UK. You just have to take the time to learn the culture as well. And that can be done with things like films and TV stuff like that, I guess.
And that's just interesting as well. Or more interesting in many ways.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, if you want to master the language, you've got to master the culture as well. The two cannot be separated. That really goes for any language, though.
Yeah, yeah. So how does quick question about what you do? How is it possible for you to teach other people English from you know, many different countries around the world when you essentially only speak English and Japanese?
Well, this is where the big contradiction in my business comes in, that a lot of people find quite difficult to grasp, but actually tends to work really, really well for me. I specialize in the high intermediate to advanced levels, mainly people who actually live in English-speaking countries. So if you think of the typical Polish person living in the UK, perhaps working in a restaurant, working in a pub, often working in companies and things as well, often business owners, entrepreneurs themselves, who get on okay in the language, but they lack that native-like polish to their English. Though that's what I specialize in, working specifically with those kind of people. So I'm marketing in English to people who need to learn English and teaching English in English, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It all seems a little bit contradictory, but it works surprisingly well.
Yeah, so they know enough English to be able to learn more English, basically. Learn the nitty-gritty.
Yeah. And once you get to the sort of level of the people that I'm working with, a lot of people don't, and it's one of the big mistakes people make. But once you get to the higher levels in a second language, really you want to be separating it from your native language as much as possible anyway, and you should be learning the language in the language, kind of like what kids do, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And just switching again, what's the sort of Japanese dog culture like over there? Attitude to dogs,
now,
ownership.
This is something, a slight disclaimer here. Everything I'm saying here, I'm pretty much just pulling out my ass because I don't actually know.
Well, you've got eyes, haven't you, though? You've seen.
Yeah, but I what I should say, I guess, is this is what I know from observation, because I knew you were going to ask me this. I guess it's the same, really, as anywhere else. People love their dogs. Well, the people who have dogs love their dogs. I'm a dog person myself. I always had dogs when I was growing up. Unfortunately, my wife is very, very allergic to them. So unless I ever plan to get rid of my wife, I won't be getting a dog.
You don't need to reveal on this call.
Yeah, and if I ever do decide to get rid of my wife, the first thing I'll do is get a really big dog. A really hairy one. I don't know what it's like outside of Tokyo. I've hardly been outside of Tokyo at all in 12 years, actually, which is quite depressing when I think about it. But I mean, certainly in Tokyo, people tend to have small dogs. And this is the thing that really comes to mind when I think of dog culture in Japan. Like in the UK, I think of big dogs, the bigger, the better. Whereas in Tokyo, you know, we have no space. Everybody's living in a shoebox. You see a lot of chihuahuas and these little small dogs. Pugs are very, very popular in Tokyo. Poodles as well. Some fashionable parts of Tokyo, you can take your poodle to get it dyed in various different bright colors. I don't think it's not as popular as it was 10 years ago. I remember when I first came here, it seemed to be in fashion to have your dog dyed green or something stupid like that. Seems to have disappeared for the most part now. You don't see many big dogs. Occasionally near where I live, I see somebody walking a big Akita dog. You know the Akita?
Akita
King.
Yeah.
Akita, yeah.
Yeah.
They're native to the Akita region of Japan, which is right up north where it's snow country. It's snowed under for a good proportion of the year.
Yeah.
Don't see them very often. Absolutely beautiful dogs though.
Yeah. Occasionally
see one around here. They must have it like under the air conditioner in the summer all the time because it's really hot in Tokyo at the moment.
Yeah.
You see the Shiba dogs a lot. Obviously, they're native to Japan.
Yeah.
I'm exhausting everything what I know about dog culture in Tokyo.
What about do you have dog walkers and stuff as well over there or what? Obviously, they have a lot of groomers and things, won't they? But
that's a good question, actually, and something that I have been thinking about. I don't actually know. They definitely have groomers. They groom dog salons are all over the place.
Yeah.
Even like in our suburban area of Tokyo, you've got dog salons all over the place. Dog walkers, yes. I've never actually seen it advertised, but I'm pretty sure it does exist. In fact, there is one guy who I always see walking up and down the river. We live in a weird part of Tokyo that has a lot of I guess you'd call them canals. They're not really canals, but they're not rivers either. And I often see this guy walking like five or six dogs up and down the rivers. I think he's probably a dog walker. Next time I see him, I'll stop him and ask him.
Yeah. But we'll have an update. Yeah, because I mean, I just assume that they would, yeah, you know, and trainers and stuff. They must be out. But like you say, if you without being a dog owner, you wouldn't be as much, I suppose. Your radar wouldn't be up as much for that kind of thing, would it?
Yeah, not being a dog owner, I'm not 100% sure, but dog training definitely. I mean, again, I think it's the same as anywhere. People who love their dogs really, really are passionate about their dogs. And so, I would be extremely surprised if it didn't exist in the same kind of scale.
And if not, a business opportunity for someone who wants to move out to Tokyo.
Yeah.
If there's
not
only...
for my wife, man.
Definitely not, no. So why should people, why should or should people anyway, what's the benefits of learning like another language? I'll be honest with you, I'm quite lazy, but I enjoyed languages at school. And I did well at French, you know, talking, this is just at senior school. But when I go abroad, I like to learn, you know, a few words and stuff, and or as much as I can, you know, be bothered to learn. And I've even tried to do a couple of home study courses and this kind of thing. And I quite like it, you know, I just quite like the idea of it. But I haven't had enough commitment to commit to learning the full language. But what are the benefits of that, of doing that?
Oh, God. Where to start? Again, it's another huge... I mean, there are loads. And I guess very broadly speaking, you could say that there are the practical benefits of learning the language. You go abroad, you can use it with people who don't speak English. Admittedly, depending on where you go, you may not get that many opportunities. And it's one of the very frustrating things for people who speak English as a first language, actually, is it can be very frustrating to actually use the language you use, because everybody wants to practice their English when they not everybody, but most people, yeah, in the touristy kind of places that you might want to go. So, I mean, obviously, there are the practical benefits. There are psychological benefits. One of the really big benefits that I got from learning Japanese, actually, and reaching the level that I did, well, for a couple of different reasons. I actually got an F for French at school. I totally failed it. I hated it. I couldn't stand it. I mean, I was a useless student anyway. I was the kind of student who didn't do my homework, was constantly in detention. I was a real pain in the ass. My homeroom teacher told me I would spend my life working in a factory, and that was all I was fit for. And I did work in a factory for a while, actually. That was the kind of student I was. And French, not a chance in hell. I failed it. But I kind of came to Japan thinking, like, who am I to learn a language like Japanese? I'm not talented in languages. It's not something that I would be able to do. And then surprised myself when it wasn't actually that difficult to get to a pretty good proficiency in the language. So that really gave me the sense of, I mean, I can do anything that I put my mind to. It was a real confidence boost. But, and then also, I mean, things like, alongside that, I guess when I was a kid, I was always very shy and very introverted. And I guess I still am to an extent, although people tend to say that that surprises them when I say that. I guess I'm just good at being sociable along with it. But when you are learning a foreign language, I mean, you're gonna screw it up. You're gonna butcher the language. When you go out and you've got somebody in front of you who doesn't speak English, and I ended up working in a Japanese company, and, you know, most of the people I were working with didn't speak English. You don't really have a choice. You've just got to do what you can, and you're going to screw the language up. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to say stupid things that are embarrassing and makes you sound like a total idiot. But you just get the job done. But the result of all of that for me was that when it came to business, I've never really had any resistance to doing a lot of the hard, uncomfortable stuff, because I've had that experience of being uncomfortable speaking a second language for the last 10 years. You know, things like telephone, like selling on the telephone, I mean, there's nothing in comparison to standing up in front of a load of parents at a school where I worked, having to give a speech in Japanese. You know, it's same with I don't know, YouTube videos, events and things. I mean, it's in a way, learning Japanese and getting used to looking like an idiot has just prepared me for everything else that I do in my business.
That's really it. Sorry, go on, carry on.
Yeah. So that's the big thing for me. Then there are the more standard answer, which would be that there are loads of cognitive benefits. People who speak more than one language tend to have higher general intelligence. They tend to score higher on in general intelligence tests. They tend to be better at planning, prioritizing, decision-making, creative tasks. And that's all related to how... Yeah, it's related to how the brain basically manages its separate languages. It gets a little bit technical, but when you have two languages, like if you, for example, you show a book to someone who is a monolingual will see a book and it's a book. They don't have another word for it. It's just a book. But somebody who knows, say, Japanese as well, or say French, will look at the book and what's the word for book in French? Livre. Or hon in Japanese. Well, suddenly now my brain's got to choose between two alternatives. Is it a book or is it a hon? And when you've got more than one language in your brain, they're like small children that are constantly bickering and fighting between each other to be the center of attention. It's like both of your languages want to be used as much as possible. They're always active. They're always fighting. And the result of this is that the brain needs to suppress the language that you're not using. It's got all these complicated suppression mechanisms that uses context and whatever language it is that you're speaking at the time, and there are all these constraints and things going on. And for a monolingual, like, you're not using those processes 99% of the time, but if you've got two languages, you're using them all the time, and it's like your brain is permanently in the gym. So these control mechanisms, like focus and things like that, just tend to get really, really sharp compared to people who only speak one language. And
that's sold.
Yeah, and I mean, it'll stop you from getting all fuzzy when you get old as well. Old people who study languages tend to stay really, really sharp because, again, it's like putting your brain in a high intensity gym and forcing it to lift weights 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Cool. No, that's fascinating. Is that exclusive to languages then? Like, you know, that process, this process of things going on in the brain and stuff, is that exclusive to learning another language?
Cognitive control, probably not. No. I would hesitate to give you a proper answer to that, though, because I don't know. My knowledge of neuroscience and brain stuff really is quite limited to language, unfortunately.
No, I just wondered if there was a way to replicate that without, I guess learning another skill would probably be on a...
Well, these brain training games that you get?
Yeah.
I don't know if they're still popular. They were certainly popular when I was a kid. These things where... Like, one of them is actually based on a famous test in psychology, something called the Stroop test. But like this game, have you ever seen it, where you have a word and in letters the word says blue, but the font color is red, and you have to say the font color, but not the word that's written. But when you see the word blue written, it's an automatic process and it's really hard to stop. So you see the word blue, regardless of the font color, and you want to say blue, but you have to say red. I mean, that's the same kind of process. I guess we're talking about language control again there, but I mean, there are other variations of that and I just can't recall what they are, but yeah. So you could replicate it. I wouldn't say it was as fun as learning a foreign language, though.
No. I'm gonna broaden it out a little bit in a second. But whilst we're on this, obviously you've kind of sold it to us, the benefits of learning another language. What would be the best way of going about learning another language, or does it vary for different people? And what, you know, is there a best way?
Depends on your goals and it depends on your level. If for a typical British person who wants to get some proficiency in a language, the way that I would recommend. Is actually what I'm doing. I'm learning Irish at the moment. Totally useless language, I guess, because I've never met anybody in Ireland who doesn't. Apparently, there are people in Ireland who don't speak English.
Okay, interesting.
Which makes sense, because did you know that English actually isn't an official first language of Ireland?
I did not know.
No, the official first language is still Irish Gaelic. despite the fact that the vast majority of the population actually don't speak it. I'm just interested in it. And I talked about the importance of understanding culture to understand language earlier on, but I also believe that in order to truly understand a culture, you really need to understand its language. And I mean, Ireland is very similar to the UK in a lot of ways, I guess. Maybe some Irish people wouldn't like me saying that, but I mean, it's not exactly the same. And if I'm going to live there, I really want to get the culture. So I'm learning the language as a part of that. And the way I'm doing that, are you familiar with a system called Pimsleur?
I'm not.
Pimsleur is, he was actually a person. He did some of the very, very early research in memory and the forgetting curve and how that applies to language. And he developed something called the Pimsleur system, which is basically just a very, very, very repetitive, well, it's a spaced repetition system. You do a 30-minute lesson every day, and you're constantly revising and repeating the same phrases and expressions. For most people, actually, that's probably enough to get fairly, enough to use on holiday or something like that. And then if you want to take it further, and this is what I'm doing, although I'm actually struggling to find stuff, I'm combining the Pimsleur lessons daily. I'm actually doubling it. I'm doing them twice daily with watching as many films, TV programs, YouTube videos, anything I can find for Irish Gaelic, because there's just nothing. Without subtitles, nothing, just trying to understand in the language. And obviously I understand like 1% at the moment.
Yeah.
But it's just training the brain to understand directly in the language and to catch what I already know and see how that's used in context. So say you wanted to learn, I don't know, Italian, you would do the same kind of thing. You would just do the Pimsleur lessons once a day and then combine that with, say, a film in Italian once or twice a week or a little bit every day. No subtitles, that's the key there. Because if you use subtitles, the brain's really fucking lazy. It's not gonna pick up anything if you don't force it to, basically.
Carry on.
I was gonna say, which is why people can live in a foreign country for years and years and years and not actually pick up much of the language at all, because the brain's lazy, and if it doesn't have to get it, it won't. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. So why is it important to you then to? Or is it just because this is what you do and this is what you study for you to feel like you need to learn the language to better understand the culture of where you're moving, even though it's not a very widely used language?
Because the two are so closely connected. They're woven together. Culture and language go hand in hand. And this is something we've talked about before, but there's this idea in linguistics called linguistic determinism. And the best example of that I can give is, if anybody's watched the film, what's the English title? Arrival. I always get confused. The Japanese title is Message for some obscure reason. I don't know why they changed the title. But the film Arrival was basically all about linguistic determinism. And it's this idea that learning a language actually changes what you can think about. The idea is that you can't think something that you can't articulate. There was very early research done on this, looking at African tribes and, for example, the Wallpidi Australian tribes and the Piraha Amazonian tribes, where, for example, they only have two colors, hot and cold, is how they express color. Japanese sees colors slightly different to English cultures, whereas like traffic lights are actually, we say blue for traffic lights, and the leaves on a tree, we actually say they're blue, not green, even though Japanese has a word for green. And the idea is that if you can't articulate it, if you don't have a word for it, then you can't think it. Which I don't agree with, and I don't think many people in linguistics or psycholinguistics do agree with now. But I also would disagree with the opposite end of the spectrum, which says language and thinking are not related at all. That to me doesn't make any sense, because my experience learning a second language has very much been that it's changed the way that I see the world around me and the way that I think. And there are things that I think about in Japanese, but not in English, and vice versa. And so, again, for me,
you've got a broader view of the world.
Learning the language allows you to broaden your horizons more than simply learning the culture could.
Which I guess has helped you with a lot with the business stuff as well, hasn't it? You know, because you begin to, you know, market and stuff in a similar way that I am, and forever trying new things. And I guess that, I don't know, I guess it all just contributes to everything, doesn't it? I suppose it doesn't matter what you were doing, it would help you to just have more of a broader view.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think learning, as you, like you said earlier on, learning is learning. It's all changing the way that you think and adding to your experiences and the things that you know and the way that you do things.
Yeah, cool. So I'll let you have a little drink whilst I come back to something that you said before, and then I'll move on to something that you said at the start about like the human brain and animal language and stuff like that. Maybe body language and stuff as well. That might be interesting. But when you mentioned earlier on about the fact that you've gone through this process of learning the language and fucking up and making lots of mistakes and being embarrassed and, you know, feeling like you were crap, that made it very easy for you when you came to start a business. And funnily enough, I was recording another teleclass the other day, and I mentioned a similar thing about that, because not in any way with languages, but my performance background in the past, since I was 10 years old, I was doing musicals and shit like that. Do you know what I mean? And all kinds of stuff right through, you know, and fucking tap dancing and all this kind of thing. And star of stage, screen in my mother's chip shop. That's what we like to say. but that meant, in a similar way to yourself, you know, I wasn't, you know, doing podcasts and stuff and then speaking. Don't get me wrong, it's a little bit nerve-wracking, isn't it, the first time you do it? But it's been easier for me to kind of break down through these things and try different things. And like you said, not be afraid of being shit, I think, you know, because we say this all the time, don't we? The first email that you ever write, it's going to be shit. You know, the first dozen emails that you write are going to be crap. The first podcast you're going to record, my original podcast, we recorded 3 or 4 episodes when we first started. And then I actually looked at them, and then I went back and I said, we need to do them again. And they were like so bad, you know, and and so it cost more money to do them and stuff. But I was embarrassed, you know, and I knew I could do better, I think, as well. But this is a big thing as well, isn't it? Like a big lesson, if you want to take a big lesson away from this, would be like, you know, you've got to be prepared to be shit at whatever you want to do. Business, dancing, learning a language, whatever, dog training, you know, whatever the hell it is.
Oh, yeah. Pride, people's egos really get in their way. So, I mean,
some people's get in the way, but they never get past it. Do you know what I mean? They never get a chance to fulfill their potential at all, do they? You know,
right. There's always this sense that you've got to do something perfectly before you put it out into the world or you actually do it at all, but that actually doesn't make any sense, because you're going to suck by default, and you just have to suck less through experience and through doing it and through getting good at it. There's no room for pride when it comes to actually to getting good at, well, anything, I reckon, languages too. But
yeah, for sure. Right, so let's go back to something you said earlier on about I'm not really sure where to go with this, because I'm told you're going to leave me, because there's such like a vast, to me, it's such a vast subject language that I don't really know where to go with it. But the sort of animal language, you know, and how the human brain works and how we, I guess, actually what I wanted, I'll ask this and then you can bumble onto that. What's the benefits of, we talked about learning another language. What are the benefits of understanding like your own language a lot more? You know, and because many people, just myself included, really, you know, until I started doing this business lark and learning about like copy and, you know, words and then emotions and the effect that they can have on people by learning these different things. I'd read a lot, but I'd never, you know, since I finished writing at school at 16, I never did anything until 5-6 years ago, you know. I think a lot of people are the same, you know. There's a lot of value to be had from improving your own language, isn't there?
Hello?
You've gone off. Oh, you've gone off. Oh, you're back.
Am I back?
Yeah. I said there's a lot of value. Well, what are the benefits, certainly business-wise, of developing your own language?
Loads, I'd imagine. I mean, well, for example, the average native English speaker actually only knows about 2.5% of the words in the English language. So we certainly don't know that much of our own languages. Learning more, I mean, why not? It can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
One thing that, I mean, it's hard to say because this is something I really came to understand through learning foreign languages, but I think it's true regardless. And I think it's something that a lot of people can, should, and probably need to practice. And that is explaining things simply in a way that other people can understand. And really that's something that I have to be very, very conscious about in my business when I'm marketing. Because again, I'm marketing to people in English when English is not their first language. So I have to be very, very conscious about how I phrase things and some of the words that I use so that I don't confuse people and basically say things in a way that they're just not going to understand. But that's true of any marketing. The typical corporate emails that you might get stuffed with this ridiculous corporate jargon, that doesn't do anything for anybody, because you see these emails and you're just like, I haven't got a clue what you're talking about.
It doesn't resonate, does it?
No. So people who are good, I don't want to say good copywriters, good marketers, good communicators are able to tailor their message to the people who they are communicating it to in a way that person is going to understand simply and easily, whether that's by simplifying their words, by using more sophisticated, more difficult words. For example, when I'm talking about language and psycholinguistics and my research, the way that I communicate something to one of my clients is totally different to the way that I would communicate it to my PhD supervisor. Mm. And that, again, would be quite different to the way that I would communicate it to you and to your guys. Different people, different ways to say things. I think there's certainly a lot of people certainly have a lot of room for improvement there when it comes to using their own language. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. Yeah, and I think maybe I asked it the wrong way, because I asked it in a way about expanding your language, and it is about expanding it, but it's also, like you said, about simplifying it, isn't it? And finding, especially if you're marketing, I think the dog trainers find this very difficult, because they immediately most of the dog trainers immediately. The natural default position is to talk about everything that they know, you know, the dog, the way the dogs learn, all the dog trainery jargon, like you said, you know, the dog trainer terms. And it's like for your man in the street who don't know anything about a dog apart from, you know, he feeds it one inch, shits out the other, and, you know, like he chases pigeons, like, you know, that none of that is any. It's the equivalent to the corporate email that you mentioned, isn't it? You know, or that letter that you get from the bank that's like, you know, you just what the fuck does this mean? Do you know what I mean? Like, do I owe any money or not? You know, that's what you want to know, isn't it? You know, they're not bothered about anything else. But yeah, this in itself is a skill worth learning that you only, well, certainly that I've kind of got through writing emails and, you know, writing newsletters, whatever it is, you know, and it's a skill. I think this is a skill we're pursuing. This, I think, Doberman Dan calls it. Doberman Dan says, like, speaking fifth grade level. You know, so you're always, if a 15-year-old wouldn't understand it, you know, a 15-year-old spotty kid working at McDonald's wouldn't understand it, then you need to change it, you know, because smart people can understand big and small words, but not so smart people can only understand the small words. So just use the fucking, use the small words, you know. And it doesn't mean to say that it's just not as colourful or whatever, you know, because you still put your personality into it, don't you? But yeah.
And they're not necessarily interested in hearing the same things either. So I guess it's not just the words that you're using, but also the actual things that you try to communicate to the person. Great example of this, I'm thinking back to the art world, which can be very, very stuck up and pretentious and Jesus Christ. But the typical artist is absolutely useless at communicating what they do to the general public. Which is a problem because they, you know, even art is a business and they need to sell their work. And the kind of person that's going to buy their work is not another artist. It is somebody who wants to hang their painting up on the living room wall. But you've got this pretentious asshole who's talking about all this weird metaphorical conceptual shit that nobody really understands. And people are just like, sorry, mate, I just wanted a nice looking picture to put on my wall. Whereas if they just, you know, if they just tailored the way that they're saying something to the person that they're talking to, then it would have been an easy sale.
I wrote this because I felt like this. I drew this because I felt like this. Or I drew this because it reminded me of this. Oh, well, there's a little story straight away, isn't it? That someone can understand.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So on that then, on like storytelling and stuff, what... We talked quite a bit about this, written ledgers about it recently, and we had Vicky on talking about it, who we both know. And storytelling, you do this very well as well in your emails and stuff. And just to go back a second, you know, we were talking about simplifying the language. When I was working on my sort of book project that I'm in at the minute, which is similar to yours, really, repurposing stuff, I had a bit of a wobble. And I was thinking, oh, fuck it, do people really want... to really want to read more stuff from me. And then one night I was looking through the Amazon, and I was looking through my reviews from my old book, and it was all stuff like, you know, or this is like, it's real life doctrine, you know, it's no jargon, it's easy to understand. All these, you know, if you could draw like a mood board kind of thing for the words that were used in the reviews, it was all like, stuff that I wanted to hear, basically, you know what I mean? It was reassuring to me to think, ah, yes, okay, right. Yeah. So there is a place for this, you know, man in the street kind of way of getting your point across, you know? And storytelling's a huge part of that, you know? People tend to like the stories. How does that play across, you know, cultures in general and language, you know, with people? What part does it play with you when you're teaching people the use of stories?
I'm glad you asked. Storytelling... absolutely fascinates me, and it's something that I do myself a lot. And part of the reason for that is the academic in me hesitates to ever use the word universal, because whenever we think we find a universal thing that is true of all languages, some weird language turns up somewhere and fucks everything up. And that's historically always been the case. So there probably are exceptions to this somewhere. But that I know of, the only real universal between any culture and any language is the fact that all languages tell stories, whether it's an Amazonian tribe, whether it's the Eskimos living up in Greenland, wherever it is that Eskimos live.
Bad example.
somewhere where there's lots of ice, whether it's people in Japan, whether it's people in China, whether it's somebody in the Middle East, wherever you go, whatever language you look at, people are telling stories. And I think it's part of the way that human beings have evolved as a species and how we have survived through the last 100,000 years since Homo sapiens first emerged and first began to develop language. We've always taught each other about the world, learned about the world through stories. It's how one caveman would have known not to eat those poisonous red berries, not because he ate them himself, Because if everybody ate the poisonous berries to find out that they were poisonous, everybody would be dead. But you learn from other people's experience. One eats them, dies. The story gets spread around. Hey, you know, Ugg down the road, he ate those red berries. And guess what? He's dead now. Probably better that we don't eat them. It's all story in various forms. And then as our societies developed, we developed more and more sophisticated forms of storytelling. I mean, the oldest stories. I'm confusing myself now. But no matter how sophisticated the storytelling goes, they've always been about teaching each other, about learning about the world. I mean, the earliest story that we know of is the story of Gilgamesh. It's one of the Sumerian written on like stone tablets. But it's basically teaching us about what it is to be human, about greed and the dangers of being too greedy, power hungry, things like that. And zoom forward to modern day, I mean, every single day we tell each other stories, like the weird guy you saw in the supermarket, you know, doing something crazy, sticking loaves of bread down his trousers. I don't know, I'm making that up, I've never seen it. But you see that, what do? You tell everybody about it. You want to tell everybody about it. Yeah. You know, you tell everybody you can this amusing little anecdote, this crazy guy sticking bread down his pants. But it's the same, and it's the same when it comes to marketing. It's the same when it comes to communicating a message to somebody who's potentially going to buy your product. What's the best way to get them to understand, to teach them about what we're doing? Well, it's the way that human beings have always taught each other, by telling stories, giving examples of our own experiences in a way that resonates with the person, in the way that the person can experience themselves as if it were their own story, and then learn from him. There's been some fascinating research done on storytelling in neuroscience, which shows that when you're listening to somebody tell a story, what's happening in the brain is you're actually living that story. In a sense, when you hear someone tell a story and when you've done it yourself, there is no real qualitative difference between the memory of having experienced it via a story and having experienced it yourself. It's like we did actually do it, which is why we learn from them so well. They drill straight down into, into our emotions. They skip everything else, the logic parts of our brains, and go straight to the heart, as it were.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of something when there's stuff from like my childhood, and I think that, I don't know if it's I've done it myself or if I've just seen it in a film. Do you know what I mean? That's sort of, yeah. You know, sort of memories, like you say, they're blurred, you know, the lines
yeah,
are blurred so much, because I'm pretty sure I have done it. But
the lines are blurred. I mean, and ultimately memories are nothing but patterns of neurons somewhere deep in your brain. So there is, really, if you think about it, there actually is no difference between something that you see a film and something that you actually do yourself. But we make them different because that's what we do. But really, there isn't any difference. Yeah. I'm kind of hypothesizing now.
Theorizing. No, it's cool. Yeah, it's cool. I like it. So I guess on that, just to finish off that storytelling bit then, if you... Really, you know, we're talking about trying to say, we're talking about it. My guys know this as well, because they're trying to do it more, and it's difficult for people to put their personality into stuff and to tell their own story, because your automatic reaction is, well, no one wants to hear that, you know, no one's interested in this thing that I did, you know, when actually that's the very thing that's going to probably sell your service a lot better than, you know, any other stuff that you're going to tell. Shy away from it, but they're breaking down the barriers and we're starting to do it more and more. But if it is such a, which it is from what you're saying, if it is such an ingrained thing and such a, like a, it woven into our history and our, you know, our brains and that, if you don't use stories in your marketing and in your emails or whatever, on your website and stuff, you, you come, you, you're completely missing a trick, aren't you? Well, you're not just missing a trick, but you might as well almost not even bother, because it's so crucial, isn't it? It's not just like, oh remember yeah. to tell a story. It's like, look, don't bother doing it if you're not going to tell a story. I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the best tools that we've got for communicating an idea. So why wouldn't you? I can see why people wouldn't want to put their personality into what they do, which actually makes no sense when you think about it. Because, I mean, if you don't have personality, then what do you have?
Yeah.
You just become bland and boring and like everything else, and you might as well not bother. strong opinion, perhaps. But I mean, if you need to explain something complex to a small child, I mean, it goes back to what you said. I forget who said it, but speaking at the level of a 15-year-old, you've got this complicated thing. You need to explain to somebody about dog training. I'm clueless about dog training, but if you can give me a metaphor, which is simply a kind of story in a way, or an anecdote, then I'm going to understand really, really easily because I can relate the two things. Okay, well, if this is like this, then dog training is going to be like this as well. And the story that you've just told me has now linked those things up for me in my head. And I get it. Why wouldn't you do it? It's like writing an email and saying, okay, I am not going to use any nouns in this email, which wouldn't make any sense at all. I mean, I don't think you could even do that. But if telling a story is the easiest way to communicate a message or to explain something to somebody, then do it.
Yeah.
And use your personal stories as well, because it just puts your personality into stuff and people do want to hear them.
Yeah, they do. No, I love listening to yours. Have you did you find that difficult at the start or not, or was it something that you just did?
No, I didn't. I found it easy. It's just I'm trying to think back to when I first started my business. I guess the first email I ever wrote was a personal story, I think. Thinking back to my very early YouTube videos as well, I guess my YouTube videos in the beginning, I was trying to teach too much. So there was less about storytelling and more about do this than do that, which I don't do so much these days. My YouTube videos work a lot better these days. Surprise, surprise.
But... surprise, surprise. So, right, we're getting near the end now. We're coming up to an hour. Is there a... I guess we might have answered that with the story. I think if there is, it might be stories. But is there a kind of... Is there a crossover? How the language of sales, you know, the language of selling, is that, in your experience, does it vary from culture to culture, or, you know, like stuff that we use, like the ADA formula, or, you know, pain agitate solution kind of thing, you know, when we're, does that vary from country to country, or is that pretty much universal as well?
Obviously, I can only talk about English and Japanese, really, because that's all I know. But it's pretty universal. I mean, human beings are human beings. So the language really is just the actual words and expressions that you use really is just a detail. Obviously, the cultural thing is very, very important. And the way that you explain something will change depending on a culture. But that's kind of the same between the UK and America, the way that American people express something might be a little bit different to how people in the UK or say people in Australia express things. So the language itself is really a detail. But marketing comes down to what? It comes down to talking about people's heaven and hell, the pain they're experiencing from a problem that they've got, and the solution to that problem and the outcome that you can give people. If you can communicate to people how you're going to fulfill whatever desire it is that they have, or prevent them from having whatever pain it is that they're going to end up with, or get them the result that they want. I mean, yeah. I'm guessing with dog walkers, I'm thinking about your your own dog walking business? I mean, I don't know. I'm just guessing here, but I'm guessing one of the big selling points of that is because it's quite different and it's quite a high-end premium kind of service. I'm sure there's a lot of one-upmanship whereby one person is like, well, my dog gets walked by Dom and his dog adventures, you know. Who walks your dog?
Yeah, definitely. The higher up the income scale, the more important that is, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? The one-upmanship aspect of it and your authority and all that, it all comes into it as well. Yeah, for sure. So just speaking about Japanese, so for like the likes of Japanese adverts and stuff, then they would follow like a similar. Even though I would think of it, and from what you've said as well, you know that it's kind of one kind of culture on the surface, and then another, you know, and then another thing behind the scenes. But they would still follow this kind of, it's just, you know, benefits like you say, and this heaven and hell and selling.
Yeah, storytelling is a communication.
The reason why I'm asking that is because that they obviously we constantly hear. You know, oh well, my clients are different. You know, this is different in my town and that. And what we're basically saying is, it doesn't matter from Sunderland to Tokyo. It's selling. You know, and people always want. You know, if you package it up right, you know they'll want a solution to whatever problem is that they've got, won't they?
Yeah, I mean, if it's a problem that they're desperate to solve, and you have a solution to that problem. Then, I mean, again, I think the words, the language really is a detail. Everything else is just surface stuff. It's tactics, not strategy. I think it's the same pretty much. I mean, I guess the same as the UK. I haven't watched British TV for, we're talking about 13 years now, so I'm not actually sure. But
you're in for a shock.
The typical TV advertisement in Japan is crap. I mean, it's not. I mean, most of it isn't an example of what you would call good marketing anyway. So I guess it doesn't even really count. But I mean, the good marketing that you see here, it's the same kind of thing. I mean, direct response marketing exists in Japan. Some people even know what direct response marketing means. I know someone who, in fact, I'm going there to have my hair cut next week. I know somebody who runs a very high-end salon. And what he has done, I say has done past tense because he's getting on a bit now. He's probably close to retirement. But what he's done is very, very similar to what Kat Smith has done with her hair salon stuff. Putting together a premium high-end service, communicating that to the right people in the right way, positioning it well. I mean, he actually wrote a book on direct response marketing as well.
Wow, interesting. Yeah. Cool. Well, Julian, we've come to we've just over an hour actually, and I've thoroughly enjoyed this. It's flown over. I want to thank you very much for your time. And I would like to invite you on again sometime in the future, actually.
My pleasure and no problem. I'm sure we could talk about this stuff forever. I could anyway.
Yeah, it's been absolutely brilliant. And good luck with the move, my friend.
Yes.
And I shall speak to you soon. So thanks again, Julian.
Yeah, no problem. And thanks to all of you guys.
Before you go, my friend, where can people go to find out a bit more about you and what you do? You've got... Tell us, give us some contact details or whatever. You know, emails we can sign up for. They're well worth reading.
Well, I am, I guess, lucky and unlucky in some ways to have a name which I'm pretty sure is unique just to me. So if you type Julian Northbrook into basically anything, you'll find me. I guess the best place to go is my YouTube channel is the main public thing that I do. And I've got a video on there that people can watch, which tells my my personal story that I touched upon today in a lot more detail. My website is doingenglish.com, or just put Julian Northbrook into Facebook and add me as a friend.
Super duper. Yeah. Thank you again, Julian.
Yeah, no problem. And thanks for listening.
See you later, buddy.
Cheers. Have a great day.